Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Time to take a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, who's been a guest on this show for a long, long time. Usually comes by the first Wednesday of the month to talk about wildlife issues. And he's always happy to take your questions when you call in or when you email or when you go to our Facebook page. You can call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you can post your questions or your comments there. And, you know, Scott, listen to this. There's a sound you're going There's a sound that's kind of fun to hear this time of year.
Well, the frogs are really cranked up, Larry, especially here in the southern part of the state. So with all these spring events, it depends a little bit on where you are and the immediate weather. But, boy, the next few nights can be humid and warm, and stuff is really going to be active. We had to close the door at the bedroom patio last night because in our little garden pond, the toads were really cranked up, and that's a pretty high pitched tone, and they're only 20 feet from the bedroom. It was pretty loud.
Oh, well, did you hear any of these? Hear any of those guys? Spring peepers?
Yep, there's chorus frogs in the back. Anyway, the chorus frogs have been cranked up. I haven't got any peepers in our pond, but they're certainly working. The chorus frogs, wood frogs a little further north. The toads are wound up now. The leopard frogs will be going soon. It's
Isn't that fun time of the year?
It's just a fun time of the year. The birds are all singing. The frogs are croaking. The various other birds like turkeys and pheasants and whatnot are displaying and either crowing or gobbling, or the grouse are drumming. There's just a lot of cool stuff going on.
A lot of cool stuff going on. You know, and Todd had a question about turkey. And you know what? Let's go to Todd. Todd, hi. Thanks for calling from Middleton.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Morning.
I'm on my way back from turkey hunting, and I was just kind of wondering, with all the domestic turkeys that are dying from the avian flu, is that going to affect the wild turkey population in Wisconsin?
Well, I keep asking some of the folks at the Wildlife Health Center and my colleagues on campus about that, and so far there's no evidence that there has been any problem or that there will be. But no guarantees with this kind of thing. I know there are a lot of folks concerned about, well, the domestic poultry operation, and of course the price of eggs and things like that have people's attention. But there's another dimension too, in that Wisconsin has a lot of big pheasant operations, commercial pheasant farms, and there's some anxiety there. But again, no problem reported yet, and no problem reported in wild birds amongst the turkeys and pheasants and things like that. So keep your fingers crossed is what it amounts to.
Scott, is it true that this is being passed probably from a wild waterfall and it could randomly affect the turkeys?
It's possible, and I think that is the way it's been moving around, at least so that's what they're blaming it on. But there are all sorts of precautionary steps that folks involved in the industry are taking in terms of materials and commodities moving on and off these properties, and infected birds being euthanized, and hopefully they can put a lid on it.
Did you see some turkeys today, Todd?
I saw some gobblers, but no shots.
Ah.
Well, it's early. It's just the start of day one of period four, I think it is. So you've still got 6 days to go. So
I'll be back. Thanks.
Good luck. Yeah, good luck, Todd. Thanks a lot for calling. Well, it is kind of fun, this time of the year with the toms. Turkeys displaying and gobbling.
A gobbler turkey, I mean, it's impressive to hear them, but to see a big gobbler up pretty close on a sunny spring morning in a nice meadow, it's greened up and there's a few flowers out. It's amongst the things that we have access to in the outdoors here. That's got to be one of the most spectacular sights. And then to have them cut loose with a gobble, you know, right behind you when you don't expect them to come in or whatever. And you don't have to, it's not restricted to turkey hunters. I mean, anybody can go out where there's turkey activity and build a blind or find a place to sit and learn how to use a call and call these birds in for photography purposes or just to enjoy a morning out there. And it really is pretty spectacular.
It really, really is. And it took Emily out on her second hunt, turkey hunt, and we had some sandhill cranes going mm-hmm. up there that was near us, and the turkeys gobbling. It was quite an adventure for her.
Well, that's one of the things about turkey hunting, and again, this kind of activity is accessible to anyone, not just somebody who happens to hold a turkey permit, but when you're out there, of course, turkey hunters are in full camouflage and
trying to sound like a turkey.
You're sitting there, and nothing really can see you if you're doing things right. And all sorts of other stuff will walk by at very close range. You know, sometimes you'll have a bird or a tree frog or something virtually plop down on your shoulder or whatnot, and mm-hmm. and that's one of the things that. Keeps your mind operating while you're sitting out there.
Now, is there a new there's a new turkey management plan in the works from the DNR?
It's been completed. The management plan is designed to provide kind of an overview of the entire program. In fact, I'm glad that came up. Let me find a little entry about it here, because it's unlike some management plans, which can be a little dry and technical uh-huh. and so forth. This one's really been designed with readers and turkey enthusiasts in mind. So it includes, the plan was to make it attractive to the eye, and there's good general information on life history and ecology of turkeys, the history of the turkey program in Wisconsin, the goals for this particular plan and for the future, and then lots of information that they've been collecting through research and surveys and so forth over the years. So it was not intended to be an entirely technical document, although it will serve to guide the turkey program. It will be, if it's not already, available online, and hard copies will be available at the DNR service centers later this summer. So anybody who's keen on turkeys for whatever reason, whether they hunt them or like to watch them or have them on their land or are just plain curious, apparently this is, in my opinion, a real step in the right, a positive thing to develop a plan that will be attractive to everybody, not just the biologists who are managing the turkeys.
And here I live right in Madison, and we have turkeys all over the place in my neighborhood over on the east side of Madison, mm-hmm. and I think they're pretty much over on the west side of Madison and probably in a lot of other cities as well.
Well, they're all over the place. I mean, people are, how many turkeys are there? But you know, the DNR has moved away with deer and turkeys and some other species of kind of being preoccupied with the numbers game. That was one of the recommendations that came out of the Deer Czar report and some changes in management philosophy. So we don't necessarily have a population estimate, and they'll be going by whether people are satisfied with the number of turkeys they're seeing or hearing or whether they aren't. So are there enough or not enough? And I guess I'm sort of curious if the listeners who are out in the countryside where they're used to seeing turkeys in their fields, I'm kind of curious to hear what they've been seeing, because my experience over the past couple weeks of being out hunting is that the turkeys have been very quiet, at least where I've been, and whether that's an indication of just a behavioral response to the weather or something else, or whether it means, there's less turkeys after
the winters
we had or whatever other factors are involved. I'm kind of curious to see whether people think that in the light of are there enough or not enough or too many, what do people think? What are they seeing? So,
taking a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, our wildlife ecologist. Great to have him along. Thanks for listening. If you would like to join in, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And we can get you on pretty quickly, so give us a call. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. We got an email from Todd from Delavan who wondered, how do gophers navigate when they're tunneling? More specifically, how do they locate and tunnel to join an existing one when they're underground?
Wow. That's a pretty good question. Not something I guess I've ever thought about. But, you know, I'm not sure that they are necessarily navigating as much as they're following. You know, I think they can sense what depth they're at. Mm-hmm. And so they're following that contour the way in a boat you might be following the 10 or 12 foot depth if you're fishing or something. So they're moving along in that regard. And they're cued in, whether it's moles or pocket gophers or ground squirrels, cued in by the depth they're interested in and the soil moisture they're interested in to either find earthworms in the case of the moles or roots or other things that the gophers might be interested in. I think the notion that they hook up or connect or intersect with another tunnel is entirely random. And I say that because back when I worked in trying to control some of these animals that were a bit of a nuisance, like pocket gophers, the primary technique for dealing with those animals was to use a machine called a burrow builder, and it would simply draw or drag a little torpedo-like device behind a tractor or farm implement that would create an artificial burrow in a grid pattern across a field or meadow that was infested with pocket gophers at the right depth, the mean depth mm-hmm. that the burrows would normally be, and they'd simply create this grid, and then as the gophers were doing their normal, hey, I'm going from point A to point B, whatever they have in mind, they would hit these artificial burrows and then use them.
Just go.
And then find the toxic baits that were distributed by the machine as it mm-hmm. was making the burrows. So I'm not sure that they're necessarily headed in any particular place as much as they are following the depth and contour and soil moisture and food until they get to a point where it's time to go to the surface, it's time to dig a nest chamber, or whatever. Interesting question,
yeah,
though.
It is. Beth wondered about deer. She saw a deer crossing the ice. This is in the Harshaw area, so north. And she saw the deer. It fell through, and it drowned. And she wondered, is it common for deer to fall through the ice during the spring? And, well...
Well, it happens. I've seen it happen too over the years a couple of times when in certain circumstances mm-hmm. when the ice is particularly thin. But deer, you have to give most of these animals some credit, not necessarily thinking and trying to be anthropomorphic about it, but these animals understand their environment and they learn about roads, they learn about floodwaters. And I think they learn about thin ice. And unless they're really being pressed, I think there's a time of the year in the fall transition and in the spring transition where they probably try and do everything they can to stay off the ice. But if they're being pursued by a predator or stray dogs or people have jumped them and all of a sudden, hey, the ice is the lesser of a number of evils, then accidents like that do happen.
Yeah.
So in the case of up at our own cabin in northern Wisconsin, winter before last, all the deer in the area were out in the middle of the lake every day.
All
in a big bunch, 20, 25 deer, all sitting out in the middle of the lake. We asked them, hey, what's going on? We hadn't been up there for a while. Oh, he said, there's such deep snow that the only place the deer can stay away from the wolves, and there were several wolves working the shoreline of our lake, is to be out on the ice where they can run and they can see. And that's where they were. So they learn about these kinds of things. And again, I assume that as the ice started to get thinner, break up, presumably the snow depth also diminished, and then they scattered around the countryside. But anyway, the short answer to Beth's question is, yes, that does happen, but probably not a lot.
So I've got a whole different question for you, and it has to do with one of my favorite birds, the Baltimore Oriole. And have you seen one yet this spring?
Well, we put our Oriole feeders out about a week or 10 days ago, put the jelly out, put out an orange to make it look attractive, and I built a new feeder this year, and we've just been sort of waiting. And I was thinking, boy, yesterday when it was raining a bit, but I said, it's going to get warm here. Either yesterday or today, we'll see the first Oriole. And showed up about 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon. I looked out and said, there he is on the feeder. So there'll be lots of them around now, but I guess I'm curious again from the listeners, have you been seeing orioles in the state and where? What about hummingbirds? I haven't seen a hummingbird yet. In fact, I haven't seen any swallows back at my place yet either.
I haven't either.
There was a big bird activity or event last Saturday, and I think the report I saw, they found through the birdathon 75 species with that particular group, but very few warblers. So the insect eating stuff, the warblers, the swallows, and then of course the hummingbirds and orioles don't seem to be back, certainly quite not yet. In large numbers and quite yet, but as we creep up on the middle of May, all that stuff will be everywhere.
Scott Craven, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer today on this edition of The Larry Mueller Show, as we talk Wisconsin wildlife with Scott here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're talking about wildlife with Scott Craven. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tom in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. I'm a crane guy, Larry.
Okay.
I retired last June, and I've been devoting my time to following cranes. I spent the winter down in Rockport, Texas, near the Aransas Wildlife Refuge, where the whooping cranes winter. I had a wonderful, wonderful winter down there. Anywhere from 7 to 14 whooping cranes in front of the field that I watch almost every day.
Great.
I went from Texas to Nebraska for that wonderful, wonderful crane migration, about 600,000 sandhill cranes moving through the Great Platte River Valley just outside of Grand Island. Volunteered there at the Crane Trust. Interestingly enough, Scott, the lead biologist that just took the job with the Crane Trust, his last name is Caven also.
Interesting.
I'm wondering if there's a connection. Andy Caven, C-A-V-E-N.
Oh, Scott's is C-R-A-V-E-N.
There's an R in my name.
You guys ought to get together.
Well, I guess we should. You've been in some pretty nice places watching cranes.
Yeah, you sure have.
Yeah. Well, I'm blessed to be back in paradise. I'm in Wisconsin. I've got a website, Whooping Crane Gossip at gmail.com, and I would love to hear from anybody that spots whooping cranes or sandhills in the state. You know, we got birders everywhere, but not a lot of us that are devoted to cranes. Follow them. Have there been sightings? I've been in contact with the Nisida people up at the Wildlife Refuge, and they've had the whoopers back from the reintroduced flock for several weeks. I've not been able to get up there yet to see them, but I understand there's quite a number of them in that area.
Hmm. Well, good. I can't think of anywhere where I've been, including any time I'm in the yard, that I'm not hearing sandhills this spring. They seem to be all over the place in every available low spot, wet spot, marsh, or whatever. So I think the listeners are probably all hearing sandhills, but the whoopers attract a lot more attention because of their scarcity. So folks now have a place to report their information. So
yeah.
Good luck with that.
Tom, what you should do is go to my Facebook page and enter your information on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And then people will have it available, and they can go to it that way. So they can just and what I'm saying is, post on my page, and then people can link into it. And thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. We have Corey and Delavan up with a question. Hi, Corey.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
My question, and actually, I have several about this same subject. I have a little fox family that's living under my deck that goes around my pool, so it's a low deck. And it started out where we saw five babies, and actually they're, you know, like toddlers jumping around and playing, and my backyard is their playground. Now I only see three, but I do believe I see mom and dad also. So my questions are, does mom and dad stay with the family? Do they stay together? And will this family leave once the babies are mature?
Not necessarily. Well, first of all, where are you in general? Not your specific address, but where are you around Madison or
Delavan?
In Delavan. Okay.
And my home is it's in the city, but my backyard backs up against a creek and ravine type thing, so it's wooded and it's all natural back there.
Are these gray fox or red fox?
They're red.
Okay. Well, it's a cool thing, and there's nothing at all unusual about it anymore, Corey. In fact, here in Madison and even on campus, the red fox resident on campus have been attracting a lot of attention over the past couple of years and have spawned a graduate research study in my department that my colleague David Drake, who's on the program here alternate months, is working on. And you might want to call in again next month, and David can tell you about some of the findings of the red fox they're monitoring with radio collars, transmitters. So in answer to your question, or a couple of things you mentioned, the litter seems to have diminished from 5 to 3, and that's certainly quite possible. There are lots of things that might befall a fox pup. The parents will stay with them and provision them into the summer, but as the pups get to the point where they're large enough and independent enough, eventually, later on in the year, they'll disperse on their own. But in all probability, the parents will stay around the area, that natural space that you described behind your home is probably their home territory, and whether any of the young find room to settle there or not, time will tell. But, barring something happening to the adults, they're likely to stay in the area and could return to den under your deck again next year.
I kind of don't want them to do that.
Well, then
I have a little dog, and I've been chaining him out in the front yard because I don't know what a fox would do, and I don't know what a female fox would do if her babies are threatened. And
well,
he wants to play with them in the worst way, but I keep him out front.
All right, so your behavior is prudent, but I think given that they're now there, and you seem to be. Your management of the dog is prudent. You seem to enjoy the fox, but would like them to move on. They will move on naturally. But once that's happened and you think the pups are no longer dependent on the nest site, they've started to move off and forage, then I think later on in the summer, certainly by fall, I think you should modify the deck so that if you don't want them back there again in the future, they can't get under there. And that's going to mean skirting. You said it's a low deck, so yeah. There's probably room. It could be a do-it-yourself project for your family, or it could be something you hire a contractor to do. But have them trench in and attach a heavy wire mesh or screen, skirt the deck, in other words, so that the animals can't get back under there.
So and something like mothballs wouldn't just keep them away? No.
The mothballs and other kinds of repellents will irritate them, and they might move for a short period of time, but those things evaporate very quickly, and it can get expensive pitching mothballs under there.
And they're kind of toxic, too. So
yeah, they're not a good thing to have in the environment, and if you just miss one application next spring and all of a sudden they're back under there again, you're back in this cycle again. So I really think the long-term solution to peaceful coexistence with the foxes is to skirt your deck and make sure that they trench whatever you use for material, that it's trenched down into the soil and there's an outward bending flange on the bottom of the material. Then the foxes can't tunnel around it.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. All right, they've been a joy to watch. It's really been fun, but we do need to use our backyard.
I understand, and you should use your backyard. The only thing you really need to be prudent about is your dog.
Yeah.
And but in terms of going out and sitting, over the years, this is, like I said, not an uncommon call. And I remember on the program, Larry, one caller from Door County who had a family under a shed in the backyard, and they'd go out to sit on their patio during cocktail hour and have a drink and some cheese and crackers or whatnot, and the foxes would immediately come over and sit on the edge of the patio, waiting for them to pitch them a square of cheese or something. So these animals adapt very well to human activity and a human-dominated landscape, and you just learn to live with them, and you can still enjoy having them around, but you don't have to have them denning under your deck.
You know what I did, Corey? You know what I did?
Thank you. You've answered all my questions.
Yeah. I'll tell you what I did with my deck. I had everything imaginable living under it at one time or another. I took the deck off and made and put in a really nice stone deck, but it was right to the ground, and that eliminated my problem. It cost a little money, though. That was the downside. The good side was that I had a really nice place and no wildlife underneath. Julie in Belleville, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I thought I would just tell you that we had two hummingbirds at our feeder this morning right outside the kitchen window.
Is that the first morning you've seen them?
That is.
Oh, excellent. Well, yeah. Good. I'm glad I've got the hummingbird feeder out, too. I just haven't seen anybody there, so they're likely due in.
I think they're on their way.
I think when I watched the weather this morning, you said the wind was supposed to shift. It's been east for the last couple of days. It was supposed to shift around to the south and get really warm and humid. I'm guessing that most of the birds we've kind of been waiting for, the swallows, the warblers, the hummingbirds, and the orioles in a big way, will all be back in the next 48 hours.
Yeah. Thanks, Julie.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Appreciate the call. And Ben in Paddock Lake. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me. Hi.
Sure. Hello. What's on your mind?
Well, actually, I was driving down a local highway here a couple days ago, and we normally pass by, actually, there's a large dump just north of here, and there's a lake right outside the dump on the side of the highway, and we were driving by, and my mom said, hey, look at that hawk in the tree. So I looked out, and it turns out it's actually not a hawk. I said, Mom, I don't think that's a hawk. That's a bald eagle. So we pulled off the side of the road there, and sure enough, bright white head, white tail, and about 8-foot wingspan. It was huge. It was beautiful. And I was just wondering, do they come this far south? Because I've never seen eagles down here.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think that there's probably any county in the state now where there's not a reasonable chance of seeing an eagle. I mean, they're nesting along creek bottoms out along the Wisconsin River in southwestern Wisconsin and along
Dane
the
County.
Mississippi and Dane County. And they're becoming more and more. They're still spectacular, and it's still unusual. And the farm that I hunt on in Iowa County, there's an eagle nest now that's been active for the last, four, five, 6 years at least, right along Trout Creek, and I was out there last week, and the eagle was soaring over the valley, and it's just
pretty.
For folks who have been around southern Wisconsin for a while, it's just another change in the wildlife community that I think most people welcome, but lots of northern animals seem to be creeping south, bobcats, bears, fishers, eagles. And that's a good thing, I think, as far as most people are concerned.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, I'd agree. It was just beautiful seeing it and heard your show, so I thought I'd mention.
Well, thank you
good.
For calling.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. And, Scott, you mentioned animals getting further and further south. John from Cold Springs emailed us and wondered how far south in our state are bears established. What are the southernmost counties? We've had bear probably all right to the bottom of the state, but I mean, in terms of having established animals.
Well, there certainly is. I think the easiest thing for John to do is go to the DNR website and do a little clicking to get to bears, and there'll be a range map in there where there are color-coded portions of the state where they're described as abundant, common, uncommon but present and rare, and then he can see the actual boundary lines drawn through the counties.
Yeah.
But they've certainly extended and established themselves in a big way into the central part of the state. And as you say, again, there's hardly a county that's immune. The difficulty with bears is that although they may get down into the southern part of the state, the landscape is heavily impacted by humans, and they run into problems. So the question about being established is sort of an arbitrary one.
Yeah.
Certainly the central part of the state, and they've been down here and made it for a couple of years, hibernated in some parts of southwestern Wisconsin, but they often something befalls them in terms of an interaction with humans, and that's the end of the line.
Michelle in Coon Valley, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Okay. Hi. This is Michelle, and I'm calling from Coon Valley, just about 15 miles southwest of La Crosse, and I had many orioles this weekend, and one hummingbird that I saw.
Excellent.
And, so they're, you know, they're well on their way probably towards Madison. I also wanted to say that we have a bear that also, I think, must hibernate not far from us in the wintertime and in the spring, and it happened last year, too. It would kind of meander around the houses where we live, and it actually got up onto our deck and was eating the sunflower seeds from the bird feeder, and my husband had the trail cam up and got a few pictures, and also you could see the hair that was stuck in the bird feeder. So I think he's kind of meanders through and then heads away. He's usually around for a few days and then probably heads up north. So,
well, there you go. Scott, well, that's probably...
I'm not surprised that was a caller from the La Crosse area. If you watch the weather map every night, even just the last few days, you know, when it was 78 here in Madison. Ooh, look, La Crosse hit 85. Prairie du Chien, La Crosse, and along the Mississippi tend to get just a little bit warmer, a little bit quicker. Plus, you have that Mississippi River Valley corridor.
Yeah.
So I would expect these things that are returning in the spring to kind of move up that area first. So Michelle's call bears that out.
Yeah. So, thanks, Michelle.
Keep up the good work, Michelle.
Appreciate it very much. And, well, let's go to Julie. Julie Intrigo, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I've got a possible problem with the porcupine. I have a couple dogs, so I'm a little worried. Over the last week and a half, 2 weeks, I've come home for the evening, and I've met the porcupine. I live out in the country. I met the porcupine on the road about half a block from my driveway, and it walked down the middle of the road and didn't seem to move over. I literally drove right next to it, and then it would finally kind of go off. And I noticed on its back quarter that it's got, kind of in the dark, kind of a larger light space where it looks like the quills might be gone. So I'm wondering if this would be normal behavior, and if there's anything that I can do to kind of, anything I could maybe put down as a deterrent to keep it away, at least from the immediate house area.
Oh, boy.
And well, Trigo, you're going to find porcupines in that area.
Porcupines are kind of a fact of life in the North Woods, but first of all, the fact that it didn't get out of the road, I just wouldn't have the patience. At the speed a porcupine moves, following one down the road would be very difficult for me, but they're not very fleet of foot because they realize... they're not very fleet of foot, and there's good reason for that. They realize that really nothing's going to mess with them. The light spot on the back was probably not bear, but actually it was a big old porcupine. Those are the white tips of, that's where the heaviest, longest, thickest quills are on the back and down the tail. So that's probably what you were seeing. And as far as one that's around, if, you know, we like to promote peaceful coexistence with wildlife, and if there's no immediate problem from any animal, there's really no reason to do something about it. And in the case of the fox den we were talking about a minute ago, there's a solution there that will prevent the foxes from returning again in the future. With porcupines, that's not really the case. If it was a case of the porcupine's gnawing on the siding of my house or something like that, there are repellents and kind of armor plating and hardware cloth and sheet metal that can solve problems like that. But one that's hanging around close to the house, if you've got dogs and you're really worried about that, if it were my... Well, it has been my place in Price County. I would think about removing the porcupine.
Yeah.
And if you see it occasionally, that won't be too difficult to do. And you'll have to kind of make the decision about how that's going to happen and when on your own.
Yeah.
But there's really nothing you can do to just generally discourage porcupines from being in an area suitable habitat. They're going to be there, and you just need to be prepared for the consequences or remove one that's particularly problematic.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thank you, Julie, for calling. Let's give Daniel a chance to join in from Minong, Wisconsin. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. West of Minong by McLean Lake, we're puzzled by no signs of marauding bears, no trash garbage, no sightings, which are generally the case in the early spring. Can bear populations dramatically fluctuate from year to year like other species from disease outbreaks?
Well, I suppose they could, but bears are not prone to any disease outbreaks that tend to do that, especially in sort of a patchwork fashion. So I don't think you can attribute what you're observing to a sudden crash in the local bear population, especially attributed to disease. It is more likely a set of circumstances that, another food source has opened up over the ridgeline or something, whatever that might be.
Yeah.
Or it's possible it was also, for whatever reason, a concentrated harvest there during the last bear season. But I'm
pretty
generally
sure.
Short-term observations like that, there's no birds at my feeder. The tendency for people is to attribute that to some sort of environmental disaster or mm-hmm. population crash, and that's rarely the explanation. It's usually some local cause of an alternative food source, change in hunting patterns, change in bear behavior for reasons we don't understand. And for right now, the kinds of things you mentioned you're not seeing are good things to not see.
Yeah.
So I would sit back and smile for this season and hope that it continues. But I don't think you can blame it on a disease outbreak.
There you go, Daniel. Thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. You know, you were asking earlier for people to comment on turkey numbers or if they've seen Baltimore Orioles and so forth. And we've heard some good ones. We got an email from Kevin in Fitchburg, not far. He says, you don't need to go out in the field to hunt turkeys. They're like robins. They're all over the lawns and parking lots. All I need to do is grab one by the neck when I drive in the parking lot to work.
Well, I should point out, I live immediately adjacent to Fitchburg in the town of Oregon and in our backyard, although it's 12 acres, I think I've identified. One of the reasons I asked is that I've seen 7 different legal turkeys in the backyard amidst a lot of other turkeys, but four jakes and 3 large gobblers at a time when you know they're all different birds.
Yeah.
And yet I have yet all spring and a lot of time out in the yard working the yard, I have not heard a gobble or a turkey sound, yelp or a cluck or a gobble yet. And I know these birds are around because we see them regularly, and we've got a hen nesting in the prairie grass probably 50 yards from the house, but not a sound.
Wow.
And that's what I'm kind of curious about. What the heck is going on?
Well, I was at a farm in the Janesville area, and a pretty large farm, and there were seeing probably 30 turkeys, maybe 8 or 9 gobblers, and they were noisy.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they, they didn't come to the calls very well, but I had some hens. I was able to call some hens, and the gobbler followed the hens.
I just wonder if in the semi-urban or ex-urban environment that these turkeys, like some other animals, have somehow learned that it's in their best interest to keep their mouths shut. But
yeah?
I don't know about that, but in any event, we should point out on the turkeys, I forgot to mention it earlier, for folks who are interested in the hunting situation, we just started this morning the first day of period 4, the 4th of 6 week-long turkey hunting periods, which extends through virtually all of May. And there are still three periods are now behind us, and I think there is still surplus tags available over the counter. If you go to a DNR service, if somebody said, gee, I'd like to try turkey hunting, you still have 3 weeks, and there are still permits available. Otherwise, they're done by a draw system during the winter, but still some available for some
certain
parts
areas
of the state. Right?
Yeah, there are some areas that are closed down. I know Unit 2 is closed down for sure, but you're absolutely right. Scott Craven, our guest today, as we take a look at the world of wildlife. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist extraordinaire. Glad to have him along. Thanks for listening as we talk the world of wildlife. Lots of callers online at our 800 number, 800-642-1234. You can still email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question or a photo or even hand a photo. Love to see the wildlife photos on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show. And certainly while you're there, click like. We'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. Let's go to Sylvia in Appleton next. Sylvia, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. I'm glad Scott's back helping out again. I did have both Orchard and Baltimore Orioles and a beautiful rufous-sided towhee in my yard yesterday.
Wonderful.
The main reason I'm calling is to comment on the gentleman that was asking information on the whooping cranes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that's the best idea. We've already encountered a couple, and the guy has this big camera. They were walking someplace where they were not supposed to in a prohibited area, claiming they found a nesting whooping crane. Now, if information like this gets out, I'm afraid that the photographers are going to be there harassing the birds, just like they did with the snowy owls and that. And we met another family that was also walking in a prohibited area, and it's very hard for the police type to patrol all this. But if it's fine, if you go down to Horicon, if you see them along 49 or something or on the auto tour, but to go out looking and posting information where these birds might be resting or especially nesting. I mean, they put a lot of money into reestablishing these birds and to have people harassing them just to get
not a
photographs.
Good thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good points.
Well, that's a very good point, Larry. I'm glad she brought it up, and people will have to act be appropriately according to their conscience or interest in this as far as requests for that kind of information. There are other places where that kind of information is collected, like the Nature Mapper program. But I think the safest thing to do, especially if someone makes an encounter with a rare species or a species that's in the midst of a restoration effort like the whooping cranes, and report that to the local DNR office. The data can be very important to the management of the cranes. But in terms of making some of this information on some of these rare species kind of in the public sector, it can cause problems. And we've seen this before when a rare bird shows up in the state and all of a sudden that information is out. And, I mean, literally, if you say, oh, I saw such and such in my backyard, and pretty soon, you know, people are directing traffic and whatnot because people want to add it to their lists, I mean, we'd hope that that kind of thing would be done discreetly and in an environmentally sensitive way, but not always. So, especially with nesting, maybe it's best to keep quiet about that.
Thank you, Sylvia. Appreciate it very much. And Connie in Portage has a comment for us. Connie, hi. Oh,
hi, Larry. I have sort of a funny story about Orioles. For 10 years, I've used the same feeder. I put my jelly out and the liquid and oranges and everything. And they come back. I write it in my bird book on the 5th every year. Well, everything else came back a little early, so they did. For 3 days, I've waited for them to go to the jelly because I usually use up 12 jars a year.
Wow.
And they wouldn't go near. I put a new feeder out. So they wouldn't go near it. So I went in the shed, got my old feeder out, washed it, and put it out. And now there were four males and a female. Don't you think that
Go. That's pretty strange. Go figure. I mean, that one of the things that attracts people to wildlife is these peculiar quirks in their behavior that we try and understand but can't. But and there may have been something about the color or the finish or the shine or something on the feeder that made them nervous. But
no, they were the same. Only one was bigger. I thought the bigger one, the babies could sit on it better. And it was about twice the size, and they evidently didn't like it.
They didn't like the bigger size. That's really interesting, Connie.
I thought you'd enjoy that, yeah.
Oh,
I just enjoy your show so much.
Well, thank you. It's a lot of fun to do the show when you get calls. I mean, we always have great calls, but, you know, calls like that are really kind of fun to, you know, I would have thought something like that, you know. And there you have it. You put a different feeder out, and it didn't work. Cindy in Manitowoc, your turn. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. We really enjoy your show, too. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
A couple people have called in regarding how to keep the wildlife and the dogs from mixing. And I know there's different ways of relocating the wildlife, but we always just build a nice big fence for the dogs. And that way we don't have to worry about them, and they're happy, and the wildlife won't come in contact with them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I wanted to add, except we have been birding lately, and we saw hermit thrush yesterday.
Oh, cool.
Okay.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Cindy. Yeah,
well,
fence them in.
I mean, a fence is certainly an okay idea, and it will work under most circumstances, but... You know, we've had cases here in Madison over the years where fenced yards, coyotes will jump the fence, or dig under the fence or whatever, and all of a sudden, you know, a small dog is gone, or a cat or whatever. So it's an alternative. It's not foolproof. And you may be in a neighborhood, for example, where there are deed covenants against fencing. So it's not always the solution, but maybe that's a good segue into if we're managing wildlife problems. If you want to plug that, Larry, if you want me to.
Go ahead, because I think it's really useful.
My colleague, David Drake, who's on the program occasionally as well, wanted me to mention that there's a Predator Livestock Conflict Management Workshop, and the subtitle is Using Non-Lethal Methods Effectively, which people will find attractive. That's coming up next week on May 13th from 9:30 in the morning till 3:30 up at the Northern Great Lakes Visitors Center in Ashland. And it's targeted at livestock producers who are experiencing losses from large predators like wolves and bears and so forth. And this will there's no charge for the workshop, but attendance is limited to 100. If you're suffering from any kind of adverse interactions with wildlife, then you should check on this. It's co-hosted by UW, the DNR, USDA's Wildlife Services Division, and there's a pre-registration. I don't know if you want to post the phone number or not, Larry.
Yeah, we can post that up.
But the bottom line is, I guess we could put the phone number on the Facebook page if somebody's interested in that, or call the Wildlife Services office or one of the DNR offices and get signed up. But it looks like a good session.
So it's and I can give that number now. Cheyenne will post it up on our Facebook page. But the number is area 715-369-5221. So 715-369-5221, extension 14. So extension 14. There you go. And we'll post that. Cheyenne will post that up. We have Terry in Princeton up next. Hi, Terry. Terry, are you there? I think we lost Terry. Well, let's go to Jerry in Menasha then. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. My question is, when is it safe to stop feeding birds for the summer months? I don't want them to starve, but I just don't want to feed them over the summer months for some reasons that have come up.
Well, I mean, there are always very good reasons, in some cases for the safety of the birds, to discontinue feeding, and that is that disease transmission at a feeder during the warm season is a much greater risk than it is during the cold season. Plus the birds, I mean, the environment is filled with food at this
cornucopia.
Point.
Cornucopia.
The birds can fend for themselves. On the other hand, some people like the summer feeding elements of an oriole feeder with jelly or a hummingbird feeder with nectar. Or I keep my seed feeders filled because there's a couple of families of birds that have become regular visitors. We have a rose-breasted grosbeak pair that every year for the last four or five is a regular visitor to the feeder outside the kitchen window. They bring their young in, and that adds a new element. But you have to keep the feeders clean. If you want to stop, you can probably stop now. These birds are coming back unless we get the weather looks like it's going to be pretty warm and benevolent for the foreseeable future here. A cold snap might mean a bit of a restoration of feeding, but I would say certainly by a little later in May when you start to see insects out and a lot more flowering plants are blooming, you can probably go ahead and deep six your feeders if that's what you want to do.
Yep. There you go.
Thank you very
much. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Pete and Stevens Point wondered, how long does a bald eagle sit on an egg? So what's the hatching time?
Oh, boy, I'm going to say, I don't have one of the guidebooks handy in front of me, and I don't know the exact incubation period, but, you know, they're very early on the nest, so the weather can be kind of cold. I'm just thinking in terms of size. For a Canada goose, it's 28 days. I'm going to say it's probably a little over somewhere in the 4 to 5 week range. But that's as much an educated guess on my part as anything else. But anybody who's got access to a field guide or the birder's handbook or anything like that can pick the exact time out of the database.
I wonder if Steve has got a nest or an eagle nest nearby with some eagles sitting on it, wondering when he's going to be able to see those young ones. So.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I would expect that in some cases they've already. I mean, the goose broods goose broods are out and about now, and horned owls and some species long since nested.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. He'll be with us up until 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with Scott. You stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here taking a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, our wildlife ecologist. Join in. Questions, give us a call. 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Nicole and Baraboo wanted to share about the Flyways Waterfowl Museum located in Baraboo. They currently have a special exhibit on ducks of the Gulf Coastal Prairie, and there are over 60 species of ducks of North America in the exhibit. Boy, would that be fun to see, wouldn't it, Scott?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it would.
So it's the Flyways Waterfowl Museum in Baraboo. Terry in Princeton, back to you. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, sorry about I lost you before. My question is on, I guess, relocating or somehow preventing a badger from damaging. We have a set of historic farm buildings, and we have badgers on our property. Occasionally you'll see them. You can tell them by their burrows. They are shaped like a football, an oversized football, and they are commercial industrial diggers.
Yep.
Well, we've had one the last couple of years that would get into the barn, and it's a barn in the pre-agricultural era, so the floor is simply dirt, and it would burrow in the floor, except now this year it decided to get in from the outside, and so it began burrowing, and it did so successfully, underneath the field stone foundation, which only goes down about maybe 2 feet, and it threw soil 2 or 3 feet, burrowed underneath there, clear underneath, further than I can reach. I filled in the hole once about 2 weeks ago, and it lasted a week and a half, and of course there are nomads, came back and redug it right in the same spot, and the problem is that ruins the structural support for the foundation, because unless you fill that in with concrete, it's going to that wall is going to crack, that foundation wall. So I'd like to bid him adieu. I've live trapped many, many other wildlife creatures and relocated them. Got big box trap, but I don't know how I get rid of this badger or catch them in one of my box traps because I think they're meat eaters.
Well, okay. So you've seen the badgers in this particular location.
Not in the barn. I see the hole there, and I have trail cam photos of badgers on our property, same looking hole, and I've sent them to somebody at UW Milwaukee that was doing a study on badger genetics, and they were going to come out, but of course it moves on. Then I'm fairly sure it's a badger. Because I've got. You know, I'm positive, in fact.
All right. Well, let's assume we'll go with that assumption. It is a badger. It comes and goes. You've described the hole perfectly, and they are incredible diggers. Their claws are amazing, and, well, I have a story about that we probably don't have time for. But in any event, they are a very powerful, fairly large animal. I would not recommend that you as an individual, no matter how good a box trap you have, attempt to catch one in that box trap. Because, A, I think they'll tear it up. And if you lose an animal like that in a trapping attempt, it becomes very difficult or more difficult to get them back in a trap. So the long and short of this is, I think since a badger apparently is involved, this is something where you need to talk to whoever your local DNR wildlife manager is, and either with their help or on your own, also get in touch with the Wisconsin Trappers Association and someone in your area who will help you out with this in terms of what they recommend for a capture technique. And it could be a very large, very heavy, reinforced box trap, or it could be something else. And the Tomahawk Trap Company up in Minocqua, mm-hmm. Does make some pretty heavy-duty box traps for catching large, powerful animals like this. But the run-of-the-mill trap you might get at the local hardware store, they're going to tear up. The fact that they are carnivores doesn't mean you can't put fresh meat or bait in the trap that will attract them. But I really think because of the animal that's involved in this case, you need to get some professional help and just make sure that the DNR manager knows what you're up to because they can assist with the relocation. Kind of semi-random relocation of all of the various possums, raccoons, rabbits, and things that people are catching in our cities and hauling out into the countryside is not in the best interests of the residents of the countryside or the animals themselves. So I think both to catch it and to suitably relocate it, you should get some professional help.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. I want to give David and Pound a chance to join us. David, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I was calling about the turkeys. In the last few years, it seemed like I had 10, 25 turkeys always coming through the field here every few days or so. And now this year, I'm lucky if I see 5. So it's been down from the last few years.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. I've heard that from other people, too. And then, of course, we had another report where they were thick in Fitchburg in the parking lot.
Yeah.
So with these things and all species, it always varies a bit on where you are. But I just think that I've heard more people saying they're seeing
fewer
turkeys than the same or more. So
yeah, there you
not
go.
Not a calamity by any measure, but just
still,
it's an observation. So thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And Nathan in Horicon, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I was over the past weekend actually trout fishing in Richland and Grant County. And when we were cleaning our trout, I noticed that some of them had eggs inside of them. And I was just kind of wondering if trout needed to be fertilized to produce eggs, or if they'll produce kind of like a chicken, they'll produce eggs regardless. And also a second question, my dad, he found on the DNR website, I believe, the reports of like all the stocking of trout in the streams over the years. And it seemed like in the 70s, there was a lot more being stocked in the streams than there is nowadays. And I was just wondering if you knew why that was. And I'll take my responses off the air.
Sure. Thanks.
Well, a couple of things, and I fish for trout. I'm not a fisheries biologist, but when trout spawn, like salmon or many other fish, that there's external, all the fertilization is external. So the eggs are produced by the female and then laid on the spawning beds and then fertilized by the males externally. So there's not a fertilization issue, and it takes a while for those egg sacs to develop in the female fish. So I would expect them to be in there, but it, you know, again, depending on the strain of fish and when they spawn, it takes a while for those eggs to develop in the fish before they're mature enough for laying. So that's the issue there. In terms of the stocking, I think that it's my understanding, just from what I read, that the emphasis has moved in terms of restoring and improving the habitat in streams so that natural reproduction in our best trout streams is adequate, and the regulations have been adjusted so that natural reproduction can meet the demand for fisheries pressure and a healthy, sustainable trout population that does not need to be facilitated with just put-and-take stocking. There's certainly still some stocking going on, and ponds and kids fishing areas and things like that are still well-stocked. But I think a lot of streams that formerly received fish are now able to take care of themselves with natural reproduction.
That's a good, I mean, in many ways, I think that's a good approach.
Good thing.
Yeah, it is a good thing. I had originally thought about as a budget issue, but I guess there's probably enough budget issues going on with in this natural resources area, Scott. It's really concerning a bit.
It's very disappointing and frustrating, Larry. I mean, a lot of these budget impacts in the conservation arena, and not just now, but over the past few years, you know, it's really eroded Wisconsin's ability to maintain what was once a position at the top of the game in terms of conservation and resource management in the country. And some of the things that have happened, like the threat, for example, to the Natural Resources Board to remove its power and make that an advisory committee, that has been reversed by the Finance Committee. So that is good news. But there are other things like the future of stewardship and the cuts to DNR Science Services and the cuts to the university that continue to threaten our ability to stay on top of these conservation and outdoor issues. And I think eventually that will hurt what the public sees and experiences in the outdoors in Wisconsin. And it's truly unfortunate. My position's an example. Come next month, it'll be 4 years since I retired. And I'm still doing some things because I enjoy doing this and I believe strongly in it. But position remains unfilled. Yeah. And if additional extension positions are threatened, like our natural resource educators position in the different positions in extension in the different regions of the state, and positions like mine go unfilled, then eventually that's going to catch up, and people who appreciate this kind of thing are going to see less service and less help. And I think that's unfortunate, but it's the way we seem to be headed.
Yeah, it is unfortunate. And, of course, it's amazing that it's been 4 years, to be perfectly honest.
Time flies.
Yeah, but, you know, Scott, as you know, you've continued to do this show, which is just wonderful, but you do get out and you get to do some new things, too, that you haven't done before. And I know, one, you were in Florida wandering around in a swamp in the middle of the night.
Yes, 2 weeks ago, my wife and I traveled to Florida and met up with our son and his family outside Orlando. We've done that a couple of times, but the difference this time around was we added an activity to the itinerary, at least for my son and I, and we left late one afternoon and drove down to a coastal community in central Florida on the Atlantic coast, met up with a guide and his assistant, and we went out for a night of alligator hunting in central Florida on a big, very big private cattle ranch in some swamps that were
unbelievable.
It was just an amazing place to be. Yes, we were out looking for an alligator, but the very fact that we were out there virtually all night in a little John boat with us in the boat and an electric trolling motor. So it was quiet. It was dead silent. We're in these huge swamps in literally the middle.
And there's
no
lights.
There are no lights anywhere. It is pitch
dark.
Black. The only thing you could see was whatever the guide happened to be looking at because he had a headlamp on, and that's how we were examining alligators. But it was so quiet in the swamp, you could hear all of the bellowing. I'm pretty familiar with what sounds are around here. But down there, other than a couple, we heard a barred owl and a few things I recognized, but the howling and screaming and bellowing and whatnot is... What the heck is going on? It was really pretty creepy, and there was a big thunderstorm for a couple hours, just enough north of us that we didn't feel we had to get off the water, but these periodic cracks of lightning, bolts of lightning, would illuminate the swamp and all the Spanish moss hanging down, weird insects flying around and whatnot. It was just a really cool thing to do, and this fellow, the guide, was terrific, and he runs an outfit called Custom Adventures. You can find him on the internet, and he'll take families out on his airboats to experience the swamp. Literally, to do anything you want: to go look for birds, look for alligators, hunt alligators, find alligators, look for turtles, whatever you want to do. And it was the night activity when you're in a completely foreign environment.
Yeah.
Not to mention the fact you're surrounded by floating alligators. That that kind of thing really gets your attention. And when the little trolling motor failed about 1 o'clock in the morning because we ran over one of our baited cables and it wrapped around the prop, and so all of a sudden we're dead in the water and it's pitch black and that there's alligators everywhere. I was just a little bit creeped out, especially when the guide and his assistant started disassembling the motor, and there was a splash, and I heard, "What was that?" He said, "I don't know, some part from the motor, but it's gone now." Ultimately, they put what parts they had back together, and the motor worked, and away we went. And ultimately, we did get an alligator, and that was a really amazing experience. It was like being trapped in an episode of Swamp People and on the Discovery Channel or whatever channel that's on. It was just a really neat thing, and anybody could do this. I don't think when people are thinking about Central Florida, they're thinking about Universal and Disney and Legoland and a gazillion other things, but there are some pretty neat people down there who run these outdoor adventures. And boy, you could do some pretty neat stuff. I would put that night in the swamp up against any ride at Universal or Disneyland.
What is it when you're up to your butt in the alligators? It's hard to remember your original intention was to drain the swamp or
that's,
something.
That's right.
That was the old saying that existed. It sounded like a lot of fun. Well, that's one of the virtues of a retirement, and I guess you don't have to be retired to do that either, and you don't have to be retired to participate in some of the great adventures that we've got right here in the state.
Well, there's some neat things, and one of the neatest series of adventures are the so-called 151 Amazing Adventures that are part of the lineup of 2015 field trips sponsored by the Natural Resources Foundation, and most of these are full at this point, but it was my understanding that as of last week, there were still a dozen or two that had a few openings, including my field trip that I'm leading on small mammals in northern Wisconsin on the 26th of May. I forget what number that is. It was number 37 in the lineup. There were only two spots still open, and those may be closed, so I don't want to make a big deal out of that, but there were still a few spots open, and people can go to the website, wisconservation.org, to see what's open and register if they're interested. And I think the fact that these things fill up as fast as they do every year is testament to the really cool field trips and adventures that are out there. So if you can't get in this year, be Johnny on the spot to get in
to
next
join,
year.
Join the organization and get in.
And if you join the organization, you get first crack at the field trip. So that's a pretty
that's
good
incentive. That's a very, very good reason to join the organization. And frankly, the other good thing about it is that there's so many really good quality people leading these tours. I mean, if these were not well-run tours, right. they would have died out long ago. The fact right. that it just keeps increasing is a testament to the not only to the ideas but to the people.
Oh, if it's a prairie tour, you know, these are the best prairie managers. If it's a bat tour, it's the bat people from the DNR.
It's unbelievable.
It really is, and it also speaks to the number of really good people we have in conservation in Wisconsin, and makes some of these budget issues even that more much more frustrating. But anyway, away we go.
Joe in Viroqua has a question. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, good afternoon, gentlemen. Last Sunday, I happened to glance at my bird bath in the backyard, and a large bird flew off. It had a white tail. At first, I thought it was a pigeon, and then it landed in a spruce tree right near the bird bath. And so I got my binoculars out and looked at it, and this bird happens to be a Eurasian collared dove, and it had... The way you can really distinguish it, it has a black crescent mark on the back of its neck.
Mm-hmm.
And in this book here, Sibley's book, it mentions that these birds were first released down in Florida and they're spreading north. And about the southern half of Wisconsin are considered rare.
At least for now, but they may become like many birds that have moved into the state, like house finches that arrived back in the 80s. Now they're all over the place.
Yeah.
So we may see more of those. I saw them for the first time working on a ranch in Kansas last fall doing some teaching. And what are those big things that look like giant mourning doves? Well, they're Eurasian collared doves. And I actually had because we had none for the collection in the museum, I had the guides were more than happy to add them to the bag of mourning doves during the hunting season, and I brought a couple back for the collection. But they're very, very pretty, very interesting bird. What they'll do to our native bird community, if anything, I'm not sure. They seem to be prone to hang around human development, cities and suburbs and ranches and farms and whatnot, and they aren't really out in the open countryside the way our mourning doves are, so maybe it won't make much difference, but reality is we probably can't do much about it anyway.
Yes, my Sibley book for Western North America on page 222, it has this bird indicated on there.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Sibley, that's a great book, as an aside. That's a wonderful book. Thank you, Joe, for calling. Appreciate it. Cheyenne just let me know that the Predator Workshop phone number, if you want to get involved in that Predator Workshop, that's up on our Facebook page right now. And the 151 Adventures from the Wisconsin Conservation site is also up. She's got that up as well. So,
wow. The level of service here on the Larry Mueller Show is amazing, Larry.
I didn't do any of it. She was working hard. Cheyenne was anyway, so that's wonderful. And we had an email from Pat had a red-headed woodpecker at one of the feeders about a week ago. And since then, Pat's seen that they're a protected species. Should he report this? And I know eBird would be a good place to go, I think.
Yeah, you could report that. I mean, redheads are really beautiful woodpeckers. They're not a common feeder visitor, and I haven't seen one. I've got a really nice pair of red bellies at my feeder, but I haven't seen a redheaded for a while. Big black and white with that bright red head, a beautiful bird. Whether anyone's tracking their diminishing population or not, they can find out on eBird.
Yeah, absolutely, and enter that. Scott, it's always a pleasure. Boy, the time flies by. I know you're going to be back in a month or two, and we'll do this all over again.
July 1st or 2nd.
Yeah, Drake and Jamie Knackle will be joining us in June, so we'll look forward to that as well. In the meantime, stay out of those Florida swamps. We want you to come back.
Oh, I'd go back in a heartbeat. That was pretty cool.
Oh, Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. He'll be back in a couple months. We'll talk with him again. Tomorrow, we'll get some important consumer protection information about current scams that are making the rounds here in Wisconsin. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.